I hand you over to Keith Fisher, who is not only a comrade of mine, but you know we
what became, else am I?
Well, Keith and I met at college 30 odd years ago, and he recruited me to the SWB more or less, and we've been comrades ever since.
So it's all my forgiveness. Yes. So the slogan of the party we came from, which we are unfortunately no longer members of, we're not allowed to be, was neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. And I think that's still, particularly this week, a fantastic slogan that attracted me to a notion of socialism that I could get behind as a young kid. I came into politics essentially because of the rise of the far right, of what was then called the National Front in London. It was a fascist organisation that was very active in the part of London that I lived in, and I wanted to find a way of opposing them. And the British Socialist Workers' Party was the backbone of the Anti-Nazi League, which was an incredibly successful, widely popular anti-racist, anti-fascist movement that started me at a very young age thinking about, well, if they can do that, and the Anti-Nazi League is really what explains why there isn't a Jean-Marie Le Pen in the UK. I mean, it was so successful in breaking the back of the far right in the UK that effectively they've never really been able to recover since. So that's a bit about my background and why that notion, neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism, the notion that socialism is the self-emancipation of the working class, is something, although we're no longer members of the Socialist Workers' Party, it's something we still have at the centre of our ideas, and why we formed the Association of Musical Marxists to keep that argument going on the left in Britain. What we've done, apart from holding really great meetings, a series of really great meetings, is started to publish a series of books.
These are
one
our books?
Of our interventions. These are our books. They're all very...
a design. He's a designer, so he did the design.
So, I used to look after the SWP's printing. So we've started the argument up again about the nature of socialism, the period we're in, and the type of organisation that we want on the left in Britain by producing books. Our books are really slices into the various arguments that we want to conduct on the left in Britain based on our own experiences.
Theory, history, poetry, anything that's great will print.
So there's, and Ben Watson is great. Our first book was Ben's book on Adorno, which you'll be speaking about in a moment, I'm sure. We're taking all sorts of different angles into essentially the same core argument, which is what type of organisation do socialists who want an independent revolutionary workers' organisation to form in this crisis, what should it look like? We're not saying we're putting forward a schema for you that you can somehow, I mean, we'd love you to join the Association of Marxists if we knew what membership meant. It's an ongoing debate right now. But we do want to start those arguments now. Why do we want to start them now? Well, the obvious thing for making a book on the Second World War, we thought, was, well, the period we're living in. We're going through the worst financial crisis that in capitalism's history and since the 1930s. We're looking at another military coup, potentially, in Greece in the next few days. You have an Occupy movement that has spanned 900 cities, where the central argument worldwide is an anti-capitalist argument. The period in which we live as socialists couldn't be more pregnant, more possible, and yet we find ourselves in Britain particularly in a situation where the left is incredibly weak. So one of the reasons behind the book on the Second World War is because of the period we're in. It fits the period we're in. Economic crisis, two ongoing major imperialist wars in the Middle East, the rise of the far right in Britain, again, sorry, that I puffed up the anti-Nazi League, but the far right are on the rise again in the UK, and the potential of opposition. So we picked this book by an author who sadly died in January of this year, but who, like us, shared the same political tradition all the way through his life. Ray Chaniller
was
in and out of the SWP.
Had been, and like us, had been in and out of the SWP over the decades. But essential politics remained unchanged. That notion of working class self-emancipation defining socialism, internationalists, committed anti-racists. The politics of Ray's book are ones that we fully agree with. Why do a book on the Second World War now? The period fits it, and particularly the myths around the Second World War that exist in the UK are ones that are being replayed constantly inside the UK during this economic crisis. The key myth that the ruling class plays about the Second World War in the UK is that it cut across economic class. It was a unifying, single idea that meant everyone, regardless of whether you're a member of the British royal family, who I'll talk about in a moment, and their role in the Second World War, all the way through to an unemployed miner. We were all in it together. And like today, like the capitalist crisis today, we need to recover, and this is a very common phrase in English in Britain, the spirit of the Blitz. That we are all in it together, that we, you know, there may be hardship, but from the Queen to an unemployed 14-year-old, we shall struggle through as an undifferentiated patriotic mass. What's great about Ray's book is that every page says that that idea, and he was politically active in the Second World War, is total bullshit. Do I need to...
You know what bullshit is?
Total bullshit. So it's a very short book, but page after page after page is partly autobiographical for Ray. He was active in the anti-war movement during the Second World War. That is a history that is completely hidden from the official history of the Second World War in UK schools, universities, etc. You would never know, for example, that there were 100,000 members of the Peace Pledge Union in 1943 paying subs against the war, an anti-war organisation in the UK. 100,000 members. You would never know that, for example, the differentiations of class inside Britain during the Second World War were probably at their sharpest. I'll give you a couple of examples from the book that give you a flavour of the book. In the West End of London, which is the wealthy part of London, still is today, then, when there were bombing raids, there was a free minicab service, which was very rare in London in those days. So if you suffered a bombing attack, which in West London was quite rare because it was at the end of the reach of the bombing rounds, if there were attacks in which you suffered, you were mainly wealthy individuals picked up by a free cab service and immediately whisked to two of the big West London hospitals, which had underground reinforced emergency surgery facilities for you if you were injured. In the east of London, which in those days was a very big port, like Hamburg, there were no such facilities. The American sent many journalists into London at the beginning of the Blitz and found things such as in Wapping, which is a very poor area of East London, on regularly you would find 8,000 people in Wapping, which is a very small part of the port of London, crammed into basically warehouse facilities sharing something like 8 or 10 toilets per night. 8,000 people in the dark with disease-ridden, rat-infested basements without hardly any protection. If they were injured, they would have to walk typically out into the suburbs of London 8 miles before they could receive the first level of treatment. So you went from West London with free cab services to reinforced emergency rooms to thousands of people in basements of warehouses unprotected who would have to walk several miles to the nearest emergency care. The starkness of suffering on class lines was incredibly acute. The Dorchester Hotel, which is, I don't know what the Hamburg equivalent of the Dorchester Hotel is, but it's a 5-star hotel in London for the super rich,
stayed open with electricity, with underground 24-hour restaurants, waiter service, games room facilities, all the way through the Blitz. In contrast to the kind of suffering that was going on in the working class districts of London. The modern parallels are quite amazing. There was an alert system in the UK for bombings in cities, which went from red, yellow and green. Like there is today with the threat levels of the war on terror. The problem with it, the ruling class decided, was that the escalating the threat level to red, that you were going to be bombed, meant that the factories stopped. And this was an inconvenience. So they introduced a new colour, purple. Purple meant there were bombers coming towards you, but you should stay at work in the interests of the war effort. So that you even had encodings that put people at increased risk during the period. So it is quite amazing that just some of the gritty details of the differentiation about how people suffered during the Second World War along distinct class lines. And what Ray does brilliantly in the book is to show that the opposition to the war inside the UK, it was incredibly wide-ranging. For example, individuals from working class communities, the picture of London that's used in the movies during the bombing campaign is everyone in the underground, the tube network, the underground mass transit system. This is a common picture that's painted for everyone in Britain. What's never told about that story is that access to those tube stations had to be fought for. You had to break, there were riots in London to gain access to those shelters. It was actually banned. You could be prosecuted for going into those shelters at night. So it was only mass movements that opened up those shelters in London. And obviously they were very ineffective. There's a plaque in one of the East London tubes where the panic of trying to access them led to one of the biggest civilian disasters in the history of that transit network. There were 195, mainly women and kids, were crushed to death in trying to access these areas, which were officially banned. In Plymouth, in the south of England, which was a very big navy base during the Second World War, several people were killed during daytime bombing raids, not by bombs, but by police, in trying to access shelters during the workday. These kind of elements of the history are never really recounted in terms of the picture that's painted of the war itself. The great thing about Ray's book is it breaks apart this notion that somehow there was this cross-class, that everyone was together again in a single aim for a war against tyranny and for democracy. It's very interesting, actually, that the official propaganda in Britain during the Second World War doesn't really mention the word fascism very much. It talks about tyranny, it talks about democracy a lot, lots of posters about that. But there were obvious reasons for this. If you think about it, the British ruling class were instrumental in organising Franco's return to Spain. They actually, the British Secret Service...
Franco's Rückkehr nach Spanien.
I mean, it's now documented that they facilitated Franco's return to North Africa in order to start the invasion preparations against the revolution that occurred in 1936 in Spain. Franco's Spain, given that it's supposedly sold as a war against fascism, is untouched throughout the Second World War, as far as the Allied ruling classes are concerned. And those kinds of examples about how the British ruling class themselves were deeply embedded and agreed with the rising tide of fascist dictatorship in Europe from Italy to Germany is documented fully in the book also. So it really creates a new history, a hidden history that's been more or less inaccessible to the vast majority of British workers for a very long time. So it's a very, very important book, and it's a very powerful book now, because it essentially says this is how wars are sold. This is how opposition to war is always available in working class communities and inevitable in periods of conflict like this. And this is how people organise against the war. Coming back to Andy's point, though, one of the things, because of the tradition that Ray comes from, that he's very keen to stress is that you would have expected opposition to the Second World War to come from the Communist Party in Britain. Now, in the 1920s and the 1930s, the official Communist Party in Britain was quite substantial, as was the left wing of the Social Democratic Party in Britain at the time. The problem with the defeat that Andy described of the Russian Revolution and the increasing emergence of a separate class, ruling class inside Russia, was that European Communist Parties were very much dealt with as satellite diplomatic centres for Russian foreign policy. What that meant in practice was that as soon as Molotov and Ribbentrop sit down and sign a deal of non-aggression before the war starts, the British Communist Party, the organisation you would have expected to lead opposition to the war, is crippled. All of a sudden, they go from an anti-war position as soon as the war breaks out and Hitler invades Russia. You then spin the argument 180 degrees and say it's now a patriotic war in defence of Stalin's Russia. So the organisation, within just a few years, flips from being anti-war through to a pro-war policy on the turn of a document that's signed in Berlin, and then the invasion itself. And so the people that were expected to provide opposition to the Second World War were demobilised and ultimately became, because of the turn of Hitler's turn toward the invasion of Russia, became the most vociferous pro-war advocates inside the British Labour movement. Despite that, organisations like the Independent Labour Party, like some of the very few Trotskyists that were available, anarchist organisations were still able to hold meetings not just with civilians but also inside the armed forces in Britain that were very, very successful. It's why at the end of the Second World War, partly one of the explanations of why at the end of the Second World War you have huge mutinies, again not part of the official history of the British account of the war, huge mutinies and soldiers' councils set up, particularly in North Africa, to discuss what the future society should look like in terms of workers' interests on the return back to Britain at the end of the war. Nobody knows. Very few people know about the actual disintegration of the British Army, particularly in North Africa and Southern Europe at the end of the war, around the question of socialism and the kind of society that they wanted to return to at its end. So there is this fantastic anti-war tradition in the hardest circumstances when the patriotic drum was being beaten at its loudest, that actually carries on through to winning soldiers and sailors to an anti-war position in the war, and very much shaping what became the social democratic move towards progressive things like the nationalisation of industry, free healthcare, proper housing, etc., etc., that you saw at the end of the Second World War in Britain. How does that relate to today? Well, I was amazed yesterday to watch the scenes in Oakland, California. I don't know if people have been following the Occupy movement in the USA, but Oakland, California is the fifth largest port in the US. It's an enormous facility, and it was closed down as part of a general strike movement in Oakland yesterday. The last time Oakland closed its ports was in another general strike in 1946 for very, very similar reasons. One of the stories that Ray tells is of the huge number of anti-war independent working class organisations that spread across the United States. One of the first people hung by the British state during the Second World War for sedition was an organiser of sailors who visited Baltimore, mass meetings in Baltimore, in Boston, and obviously in the bigger ports on the West Coast. These explosions, the general strike in 1946, the soldiers' mutinies in the British Army at the end of the Second World War, the resistance to the war and the way people and the way that the class divisions in British society were amplified during the war, this history has been denied us and is only exists really in pockets of the left in the UK. That's one the main reason why we wanted to get Ray's book out there, is to basically reignite and retell that history. The other reason, of course, is it's a lesson about communism. The twists and turns of the Communist Party from an anti-war position to a pro-war position, becoming the most vociferous pro-war advocates in British society during the war, was one which crippled the image of communism inside the British working class. And it crippled it to an extent that it essentially never recovered from. The idea that the communist parties in Britain were foreign diplomatic offices of a centralised Russian state meant that communism in Britain, as it does in, particularly in Western Germany, has the reputation for being a cynical, disconnected part of representational politics that Andy was talking about. It has nothing to do with resisting wars, fighting against the consequences of economic crisis, and today, the rise of the far right. That's why we did the book, and I hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much.
Would you like a beer break? Would you like a beer break? Would you like to start for a beer?
We're told that German audiences like their speakers to talk for hours and you don't get a break, but we're just wondering whether that's true and whether you want to stop for a minute for a beer break, cigarette break.
2 minutes. Yeah. Okay, 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Yeah. 5 minutes. But do come back. This is the fun part of the show next.
Oh, fuck you.
It's good pleasure. It's good pleasure.
I'm not my friend.
Yeah,
there
you go. You always do.
I've got a lot of people with that shake.